All summer long, Bridgeport and Hartford have been in a seesaw battle over who has the more bizarre city election. At the moment, the Park City, that's Bridgeport, has the upper hand. This week, there were reports that sitting Mayor Bill Finch, or maybe some other city official trying to help him out, tried to gag the police department, shutting off further reporting of crime until the primary in September. You can't do that. Well, in most places, you can't do that. In Bridgeport, who knows? I'm Colin McEnroe. Today on The Wheelhouse, stories about the ethics, or lack thereof, of public officials, the passing of a longtime state legislator, a lawsuit over the state's tribal gaming policies, and a look forward at Thursday's debates. Join us after the news. And welcome to The Wheelhouse, part of Where We Live's lineup. This is Colin McEnroe, guest hosting for John Dankosky. You may have read that as the Republican candidates are getting ready for their debate on Thursday night, some of them are using Donald Trump's surrogates. So we've been told, not officially, that John Dankosky is in Kentucky right now with Rand Paul, and he is pretending to be Donald Trump just so that Rand Paul can get used to that. I'm not sure even what pretending to be Donald Trump would entail, but use your own imaginations. So anyway, we'll be talking about some of the events in the news this week. We'll be talking about the ethics or lack thereof of certain state officials, and we'll be talking about contentious mayoral races. We'll be talking even about a lawsuit involving our tribal gaming policy. And towards the end of the show, we'll look forward to that Thursday night debate and just maybe just talk about the political field and the national race. So get ready, fasten your seatbelts. You can call in at 860-275-7266. Could probably tweet us, too. I think Where We Live is the name of the Twitter account. Isn't that what it is? I think so. All right. Oh, well, I haven't told you who's here yet. I'm not really good at this format.
Hello.
Kevin Rennie. Kevin Rennie is a lawyer, and he's a Hartford Courant columnist. He and I sort of share some space there on the, what's it called, the Insight section? They keep changing. Insight? Insight. I think we're in the Insight
section.
They
flatter us. They really do flatter us.
We have insights. And then if anything happens, if the tiniest pine needle falls in the Connecticut political landscape, Tom Dudchick scoops it up and puts it at ctcapitalreport.com. It's pretty much the first read for all of us who are Connecticut political junkies. Allison Lee Cowan, freelance reporter, former editor and reporter for the New York Times. She has looked into the dark heart of many a corrupt politician here in Connecticut. So we'll be using her for the Joe Ganim section very heavily. So we are going to start with some of these sort of ethical questions, and we will start in Bridgeport. And it's sort of Hartford and Bridgeport have been seesawing all summer to see who's got the more bizarre election, but it seems as though Bridgeport at the moment has the upper hand. And Tom Dudchick earlier this week, there was a report. It's one of those stories that kind of mutated a few times, but there was a report suggesting that the office of mayor – Bill Finch was somehow or other trying to bottle up crime statistics.
Yeah, he's trying to put a gag order on the police department, which of course he vigorously denied, and then went ahead and hired a former or current political operative to be the mouthpiece for Bridgeport politics. It's a fascinating race. You know, very quickly I had thought originally that Joe Ganim was gaining the more mind share into the Democratic convention. Bill Finch pulled that off. I think Ganim needed to win that more than Bill Finch did. And I think now Finch has a little bit of the momentum. But my friend Lenny Grimaldi from Only on Bridgeport, who writes a great website down there, says don't underestimate Joe. He still is coming out of that convention with a lot of momentum, a lot of volunteers, a lot of feet on the street, and we'll see what happens.
Well, Kevin, we call these things conventions. They're town committee meetings. I'm not sure how much gale force they really have. I don't know how much difference it makes whether you get that endorsement.
It helps in Connecticut.
Yeah, really? You think
so? Oh, endorsed candidates have a remarkable record of winning primaries. Now, that is by no means to discount this crazy Joe Ganim return. Clearly he has a following that he maintained from New Jersey over the years, and there must be a lot of discontent with Bill Finch in order for Joe Ganim to be the factor that he is.
Right.
I would say, if they had to vote today, if the election were today, I I don't think anyone would predict with much confidence what the likely outcome would be.
And we are remiss in discounting the name Mary Jane Foster.
I was going to say, and also because it's hard to know because we don't know about the Foster effect.
Right.
Because
who does she hurt? Who does she drain support from? She's probably not going to win this thing, but she may be a big factor. And by the way, I will be doing a full-length interview with Mary Jane Foster on Tuesday, in which I'm going to focus a lot on the commercials too, because she's not the campaign commercials, but she was like in all these classic. She was in a Ring Around the Collar commercial. Come on now.
And I think a lot of that shows too, you know, Bill Finch for years has refused to recognize the University of Bridgeport because of its affiliation with the Unification Church. And to his discredit, he has ignored Mary Jane Foster, who has a very important role there. And it's a major university in his city. He abjectly refuses to recognize it.
She's not a member of the Unification Church.
No, we know that, for sure.
So, Allison, you know, you have done a lot of reporting on corruption in Connecticut in the past. And so I had this interview with Joe Ganim last week where, you know, for the whole interview, I didn't consider myself to be in an adversarial situation. And in fact, I sort of thought, well, he must have agreed to this one-hour interview because he wants to say a little bit more than he's said so far about his dark past, which has involved 7 years in prison for, you know, really kind of a massive municipal corruption scheme. So I kept asking him questions, kind of saying, well, you know, I mean, when you look back at that guy, who was that guy? How does he look to you? You know, at one point I asked him, his son was with him. I said, you know, what do you tell your son about what you did and how do you prepare your son so he doesn't get into the kind of trouble you did? And there were just sort of no answers forthcoming. I mean, the kind of introspective, you know, St. Augustine kind of answers that we hope that we're going to get. But I don't know. Should I be surprised?
I think he's retained his dazzling ability to speak and not say anything, but tap dance around your excellent questions and opportunities to reflect. You also asked him how he planned to fix the city with no money, and he answered extensively, but essentially kept saying, well, I've done it before. It was sort of an empty answer and not really really telling you how on earth he could possibly fix all these things that are dysfunctional when there's so little money, maybe less even than the last time. But, you know, your point is such a good one about have you really come to grips and wrestled with what happened the last time and do you deserve the second chance? And I think it's why he's having trouble, I believe, getting his law license restored. I think that was the last I read was that the state Supreme Court wasn't exactly buying it either, that
he's got all kinds of
problems. Remorseful.
Actually, let's hear a little bit of tape from that interview, too. Here we go.
Huge mistakes were made.
By you?
By me. And I spent a lot of time. I went through a process, the legal process. I paid my price. I've openly been in churches and apologized for my mistakes. And I've asked people, if you will, and maybe not in these words, for a second chance in life. And if they think I'm the right guy, having learned from all that and with it willingness and a desire, despite what the words are, how difficult it is to personally get reengaged in this process, is an opportunity to make right on those things. If that's at bottom, maybe in part what drives this candidacy, along with an understanding and a knowledge that I can do a pretty damn good job at it when I'm on top of my game and now with the experience that I've learned.
You know, Kevin, sometimes I listen to something like this too, and I think you know, if you've fallen on hard times, you know, you're a recently discharged prisoner and you got a big alimony payments, which he apparently does, and he gets your law license back and stuff, and you're worried about how to make ends meet. There's sort of one thing you can still do, right? You can run for office.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what, you know, a young man just sentenced in England this week to 13 years in prison for being part of this LIBOR worldwide interest rate rigging scandal that, you know, that cost probably trillions of dollars around the world, 13 years. When he gets out, I think he's probably not going back into banking. Now, he can do many things to atone for being part of this big scheme. Joe Ganim can do many things. He can do many good works. Anyone can who has the desire to atone. But you don't have to be the mayor of Bridgeport where you committed those crimes. And adding to that is, first of all, he never thought he was guilty mean, he went to a jury trial. He lost. He did not express any remorse at the time. And then it took him years and years and years. It took him until this year basically to admit that he had done anything wrong. He fought his conviction all the time. All the while he was in prison. His admission of wrongdoing came as the kickoff to his campaign. That doesn't really suggest that he has much remorse for what happened. He's right. Sorry he got caught.
He went to a church on New Year's Day and yes. Made his first apology. So, but, you know, Tom, some cities – and I wouldn't put Hartford in this category. I would put a lot of places in this category. Some cities think of themselves as kind of sui generis, right? They are so specifically themselves that Waterbury. The laws of physics don't even apply right. there. So, and Providence is probably right. yeah, is probably one of them. So is Bridgeport like that too? Does Bridgeport say, you know, screw that. Forget what Western civilization has to say about this. This is Bridgeport. We do things our own way. We might very well elect Joe Gann America.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Joe has a long way to go to make that argument that he is fit to serve as mayor. But yes, Bridgeport is in its own way, its own kind of political ecosystem. And if you look at the Democratic town chairman down there, Mario Testa, who runs things with a very strong arm, signaled the fact that he would break a tie if Gannum got close enough, which is extraordinary for a Democratic town chairman to actually say that. But, you know, getting back to the whole redemption thing, and I know that Allison has written many great stories about Roland and observed him up close and personal. You know, I do grapple with the forgiveness issue of politicians when it came to Roland and his radio show, and now Gannum when it comes to running for mayor. Rennie makes a great point. I mean, there's certainly other things he can do, certainly other things that Roland could have done too, right? But I do grapple with that.
You know, they don't have to come right back at us. They don't have to come, you know, they don't. You can work on redemption. You can do good works. It doesn't have to be on the radio or trying to return as mayor of
Hartford.
That's
what they know how to do. Right, I mean, if you look at Roland, when he came back and he got a second chance, I mean, what he was able to put to work to make a living was his connections and, you know, the people he knew and his people skills. And unfortunately, he kept doing it in the wrong way and got himself in trouble again. But
Allison, I also feel like these guys are wired a little bit differently from us. I've done bad things in my life, and if I wound up spending 7 years in prison for one of them, I think during those 7 years I'd be thinking, I'm an idiot. Why did I do that? You know, there'd be some kind of reckoning, you know, and I'd be getting Marcus Borg books shipped to me so I could, you know, somehow or other come to some spiritual accommodation with my own debasement and my depravity. But I don't think anything like that happens. I mean, at the end of this interview with Joe Gannum, who's a very likable guy, when he first walks in, you see this kind of nice guy. I sort of wanted to help him make a clean breast of things. But at the end, I thought, oh, no, he just thinks he got screwed by the FBI. I mean, I feel the same way with Roland.
Well, the most intriguing thing I heard in your interview, which I would like to know a little more about, is he claims to have the support of, you know, Ed Adams and some other people who put him away, which is remarkable if it's really as full-blooded as that, and why that is and how that came to pass.
Yes, he had the former police chief of Bridgeport, who was also former police chief of New York City, in to Bridgeport yesterday attacking Mayor Finch for a crime. I mean, it's bizarro world down there in Bridgeport.
Yeah, he does claim the support. And there's been an article, I think, pretty well documenting that the FBI agent, one of the FBI agents who hunted him down, is, you know, in his corner right now.
Well, and is there sort of as a showpiece to say, oh, you know, nothing will go wrong with this guy watching me. He's the one who was involved before, and he knows all the tricks, and he'll make sure I behave.
Well, you know, and it's easy, Kevin, as you know, to make the trains run on time when you're getting a piece of the action. And so when Gannum touts the economic miracle he did back in those days, a lot of it was my former boss, Governor Weicker, who was bringing the university into downtown Bridgeport, who was bringing the police barracks into downtown Bridgeport. And so Gannum claims that he actually did a lot, but a lot was done for him.
We were pouring money. Well, we still pour money into our cities, but we were especially pouring money in those into John Roland's administration with Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport. It was hundreds of millions of dollars, really without a lot of thought. I think, given to where it was going.
As we go along here, we won't be on Ganim too much longer, but if you have comments, our number is 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You may also tweet us at Where We Live. So, and I do think that the other thing that you see, and I've certainly seen it, Allison, with John Roland, is that, you know, I mean, a lot of people really do still whack these guys on the back. I mean, John Roland... I had a friend who was at a funeral with John Roland. He said it was like, you know, it was like Peyton Manning was trying to make his way down the aisle of this church. I mean, people were getting up and hitting him on the back, and, you know, and it is, if you don't have that one person, like, you know, after the Bay of Pigs scandal, Kennedy made Bobby Kennedy be the person who challenged him in cabinet meetings. So at least somebody would be saying, hey, you might be wrong about this. If you don't have one person doing that, you can start to believe your own hype. And I think that maybe that happens to these guys too. You're just nodding in agreement?
Well, I think there's also a certain shamelessness. I mean, just to, you know, the willingness to come back and also to kind of peddle a little bit of a bogus record of even what the city was under him. I mean, I was hearing him say how wonderful the city was the years he led it, and I don't quite remember that. Or I'm wondering, well, then, wow, it really went to pot again quickly after they took you out. All that blight just appeared, and the schools just went to, you know, to pot really quickly after you left, and they must have been a shining example of excellence before. But so I'm, you know, a lot of that is spin and shameless when he's even not going to jail. And
All right, we're going to switch gears a little bit and stay. Oh, did you have one more?
Well, I just want to say the most memorable day for me of Joe Ganim's trial was on Ash Wednesday, and he came into court with an enormous, well, it had to have been more than a thumbprint of ashes on his forehead. And he just never stops. He never stops, hoping that there was some.
My memory, of course, is Lenny Grimaldi's testimony that Ganim said to him at one point, you got to grab for what you can grab while you can grab it, which I just feel like is such a great slogan.
And also, just people, I think we overlook the fact that he came very close to being the lieutenant governor of the state of Connecticut on the Curry Ganim ticket in 1994.
Unwillingly and unhappily foisted on Curry, though. We have to be fair. Curry,
well, he should have nominated his own running mate.
We're going to switch gears here and go over to the story of George Gallo. Dutchik, I'll have you set this one up again. This is the former chief of staff to the House Republicans, although he's been many other things in Connecticut politics. And he is facing now up to 15 months in prison for a kickback scheme. It's charged with mail fraud. Will be sentenced August 20th. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, someone once told me the federal government chooses who they want to mess with, and they chose to mess with George Gallo. I mean, when you look at it, you know, it was a scheme involving, you know, if I'm a Republican candidate, you go to these campaign guys and say, we got these guys down in Florida who do all our mailing for us, and they take us out on boat trips, and we fish for Mako sharks, and we have a good time, and I get a little piece of the action. So send your stuff to them, and you know, of course, that's a no-no. We don't do that. And he got caught, and now he's set to serve term. And I don't know, Kevin, who probably knows this a little better than me, 15 months seems like a lot.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot. Well,
it does seem like a lot.
Yeah.
But a year and a half ago, when the FBI made a very big show of camping out in the LOB, you just knew somebody was going to go to jail. Because
I don't think it's over.
Well, because they don't make public displays of force like that without the determination that somebody's going to be convicted. Because otherwise, it undermines their authority in serious ways. And they were going to get somebody. That was to spend 2 days at the LOB summoning legislators into an office and interviewing them about their campaign spending. It was a very clear signal that their investigation was serious and they were going to get someone. I would add, however, that most candidates – and when I was a candidate, I believe this also – is that you just assumed your campaign consultants were – no matter what they said, they were getting a kickback. You did. I said to my guys, I said, listen, instead of you getting a kickback that you don't acknowledge, I don't care. Go to someone who costs more and will pay you. I just Let's go to the best person. Don't go to the person who gives you the kickback.
Well, and I also think that to their defense, they say, listen, everyone has lists of preferred vendors that we use, and you pick from two or three of them. The problem with the Republicans was they had one preferred vendor.
Well, Allison, it seems to me one of the profound ironies here is that the money that was involved in this is money that came out of something called the Citizen Election Program. So at the end of all the Roland scandals, Connecticut thought, we've got to be better than this, and we've got to somehow or other break the cycle of pay for play and all this kind of stuff. We're going to run a cleaner election. So we started the Citizen Election Program, which dumps a lot of public money into the hands of people who are running for office. All right. There's gesticulations going on here. You're lucky CTN isn't here today.
Yes, right.
So and I mean, it should come as no surprise in a way that certain politicians and certain political operatives, if you hand them $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 of public money, they're going to treat it the way they treat all money. And that means some of them are going to do bad things with it, right? I mean, but it was a risk nobody really talked about. What happens when you give these people a lot of money?
Well, there's a lot of problems embedded in that program that a lot of people sweep under the rug. And, I think Gallo obviously crossed the line, and he's going to pay for it. And he was taken down by this crackerjack, prosecutor, Chris Matty, who took down Roland and who's awesome. I mean, in terms of just being his lawyering, his closing arguments at Roland, this is a guy who's incredible, incredible powerhouse lawyer. So
who knows who's next?
Well, but this is low-lying fruit. Is when I read the sentencing memo, it seemed to me low-lying fruit because okay, they nailed him. He had it. They rolled the documents. Boom, very clean hit. But I still felt like, but that law really isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. So if Chris Matty cares that that Connecticut's not getting the clean elections it deserves, this is like a little nick. This is not really getting at the problem.
Do you think if these candidates had been just receiving traditional private contributions and George Gallo had been getting a kickback from this Florida firm, would that have been against the law too? It's confusing because who knows who a vendor's paying to get business, and it's not like public work where there are obligations of disclosure.
Right.
I think the big issue in this was when the FBI went to see George Gallo at the LOB, his initial responses to their questions were not true. And so when that happens, they have a lot of leverage over you for other charges. They can use that to coax a guilty plea out of you. And the lesson, of course, is first of all, the lesson is tell the truth. But the bigger lesson may be say thank you for stopping in to see me. I don't care to answer your questions right now. That may be the more prudent course for someone who perhaps is not going to do himself.
Spoken like a true lawyer, Kevin.
No, it's true. It's true. And if we were talking about all these now famous tragic police stops and cars, I would say the same thing. When law enforcement starts asking you questions beyond who you are, you need to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, he was smart enough to get Hubie Santos as his defense lawyer. So.
Well, after he answered the questions, though, yeah. On his own.
Well, I know. He gets Tiffany Stevens probation. That man is a genius. It's a different kind of case. But, yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Well, you basically segue into – I know you want to be speaking later on, probably after the break, about the whole Malloy stuff and the stuff that's going on with Seek and the elections. But it gets back, as you point out, to the Citizens Election Fund. Most of these races in the state of Connecticut, I don't know what the number is, probably at least 95.9 or whatever, 98, are either they're safe seats, they're gerrymandered. Why should we be giving these candidates tens of thousands of dollars to just do what with? And well, we know what. They're giving them to their friends and consultants. So listen, here's the game plan. I'm a consultant. I have five Democrats or five Republicans who I know they're not going to lose. I get them to raise the money. They get their citizens thing. I got five candidates. They get 10 grand each. $5,000 from everybody. I make a good payday for doing what? Zip. Nothing. It's a failed system. And then, as I'm sure you're going to talk about, Colin, when you get to the governor, he takes the money and says, hey, I'm a Boy Scout. I'm taking the money. And then they go raise extra campaign cash and dump that in too. Come on.
All right. Yeah. So one of the early signs that there might be a slight problem with this is that a certain North End politician has since gone to join the choir Invisible. When he got his grant, he just kind of threw a party with it. Remember that? He just kind of, oh, really? $5,000? Whatever it was. He goes, I know lots of people who would like 25. That money. Yeah, whatever, however much money he had. He just spread it around town, you know.
Right. Ernie Newton got the check. He goes, well, this is great.
There's far more money spent on legislative campaigns now with public financing than there was before the program was enacted.
In safe seats.
Even if it's not safe, if you lose, you still win because
correct.
You still are employed for the period of time of the campaign, and every no good cousin you have or consultant you have has a job and is your driver, and you know everybody's employed. It's a full employment act for all these folks.
All right. Well, listen, do something nice for your no good cousins today. We have to take a little break here. We'll come back with more after this. All right. We are back with The Wheelhouse, and joining me today, Kevin Rennie, lawyer and Hartford Current columnist and former Republican lawmaker. Allison Lee Cowan, freelance reporter, former editor and reporter for The New York Times. Tom Dudchick, he's the founder, creator, and overlord of ctcapitalreport.com, the aggregation site that everybody goes to first if they're the kinds of people who go to things like that first. All right. So I sort of left one what Allison would call a piece of low-hanging fruit hanging here, and as we talked about corruption and stuff like that, and that was the story of the state Democratic Party's battle with the State Elections Enforcement Commission. So, Kevin, you've covered this a lot, and so this is sort of basically a fight over whether or not – it's a fight over a whole bunch of things having to do with the difference between federal regulations and state regulations and whether or not the state party can use federally regulated money, which allows donations from contractors and things like that that aren't allowed at the state
and
level.
And much larger donations.
To help out a state candidate like Dan Malloy, especially correct. A state candidate like Dan Malloy, who is receiving Citizens Elections Program funds and living under these other laws. So I don't know. You take it from there. Say whatever you want to say.
Well, right now we're at sort of a basic point where the Citizens Election Fund and the State Elections Enforcement Commission is trying to find out whether or not, in response to a complaint by the Republicans, whether or not money was improperly spent. Simple enough.
Right.
They do that all the time. Mm-hmm. They are meeting tremendous resistance from the state Democrats. And so the Democrats, the state Democrats through their lawyer, are fighting a subpoena for records. And the subpoena was served on the state party, but they want records involving Governor Malloy, Marco Jakin, his chief of staff, and the former Democratic chairman, now Commissioner of Consumer Protection, Jonathan Harris. Mm-hmm. They're fighting that subpoena. My thought was, first of all, why wouldn't Governor Malloy just hand over what he has? He's a former prosecutor. He's always talking about all the murderers he sent away. Why wouldn't he just say, oh, you know what? Here's what I have. Let me give you this. And he could say, and my chief of staff, I think you should do that too, and you too, Commissioner Harris. They could do that, but they haven't. And so instead they're relying on the David Golub for the State Democratic Party to fight very hard.
Tony nominee David Golub. He actually has been nominated.
Was he a producer?
He produces Broadway plays too, yeah. So David Golub might be the smartest. If you asked 100 lawyers who's the smartest lawyer in the state, more of them would say David Golub than would say any other name. But Tom – and the day I get fired from here, he's my first call. I'm hoping he hasn't retired or that he doesn't have something running on Broadway at that point. But he's adopted kind of an interesting strategy, which is to say – we just won't respond. I mean, we won't even give the SEC a chance to review documents, which to me, I don't know. It's probably a great legal strategy. But
as Kevin said in the last segment, just don't say anything, right? But, when you nut it all down for everybody listening at home, so here's the Democrats, and they're sitting around their offices, and they're going, we're going to put a mailing out about touting how great the governor is and his administration, this and that, and we're going to use the federal funds. And someone probably said, well, maybe how about if we put a big old smiling picture of John Larson in the content to kind of give us some cover. No, no, I don't want Larson on there. That's all
because
they had
Larson's
to do.
A federal
it's all officer. They had to right. do. And the third district put a big old smiling picture of Rosa shaking hands with the governor, and they'd be free and clear. But they abjectly refused to do that because they don't want to share the stage with anybody else.
And so the cover was that it's a get out of the vote thing. Get out
right,
of the vote.
Right,
you're
exactly,
allowed to do this.
Right.
So, but Allison, to his larger point, you know, I mean, here's Connecticut trying to correct the impression created by your vicious reporting in the New York Times over the years that this is like this horribly corrupt place. This I'm kidding, but that we have this intractable problem with corruption. It does seem as though it's probably unfortunate at minimum that the governor, through the medium of the State Central Committee, is fighting the State Elections Enforcement Commission even over disclosure of a basic piece of information. In other words, we haven't even gotten to the point of whether this was right or whether this was wrong, right? They're just sort of saying, no, we don't even have to share the documents with you. I mean, it just doesn't seem like this is a great way for us to clean up the image that we started to have at the beginning of this century.
Well, that's why, you know, I'm not sure the CEP has accomplished what it was supposed to accomplish. And it's only as good as the folks who abide by it or carry it out. And so it was well intended. But here we are, a perfect example of how maybe utterly useless it is to really get to the bottom of something after the election. Mm-hmm. I mean, forget about the fact that elections were decided when these things were happening and everything was going to be resolved after these elections. You know, there'll be the complaint will finally be taken up by the good people on these commissions. So I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, we're spending a lot of money to get clean elections.
There is another issue, I think, that is going to be raised, and that is The SEC has the authority. It was the commission gave its employees who were conducting this investigation to subpoena a lot of people. Mm-hmm. All they did was subpoena the state Democrats for these documents. Well, if the governor and his top advisors received these documents or sent these documents, they should be subpoenaed too. Why hasn't the commission included them in the subpoena? That's the sort of thing that starts to raise serious questions about how this is being done.
And also to get even further into the minutiae of the weeds, let's not forget, Kevin, that, you know, a little tucked into the budget implementer was a little measure to unclassify all these employees who are in these small agencies. So what that simply means is that a public relations person or an executive assistant who works for SEEK, who is a state employee protected by the state, is now a political appointee who can be removed and replaced with a Malloyalist.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion which we had on another day, but absolutely the case. All right, we're going to switch gears again a little bit here. I want to give Kevin and Tom a chance to reminisce a little bit about a legislator who passed, somebody whom they both knew. Tom, I'm going to let you begin. I mean, Eileen Daly was a longtime state legislator, but it seems as though the response to her death has been unusual just in terms of what she meant to a lot of people. Tell us who she was to you.
Well, I think she was first and foremost, since I lived down in East Adams, she was my state senator. I've known her for many years. Didn't have an opportunity to serve with her. But I think, you know, she's one of that. She came in with Senator Marty Looney. So they're both long-serving legislators. And I think when you look back at Eileen and what she did, she was an O'Neill politician. She was a quintessential Irish politician from Southie in Boston. At her funeral, her lifelong friend, who is now a pastor up there in Boston, gave a rousing sermon about her rise to public service and challenging other people to follow in Eileen Daly's footsteps. And I think, you know, she will go down being remembered for someone who did care.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
A funny lady, had a sense of how, you know, this is serious work, but at the same time could wink at some of the absurdities of public life and politics in particular. And, you know, she was a smoker. And I discovered when I was in the Senate, I'd go looking for our leader, who was Del Eads, who also a smoker. And they'd say, oh, Del's in our office. I'd go in and there'd be all these ashtrays with the little fans in them and I think charcoal that were popular at that time. And smoking had been banned in the Capitol.
Right.
And Judy Friedman, Del Eads, two Republicans, and then Eileen Daly – would be in there smoking. I thought, you know, they have a caucus that just transcends party affiliation. Those three of them, they have a bond that they work a lot of stuff out here in this secret smoking room. And they were very funny about it. They were just very, very funny about it. And also, she was a great shoreline legislator. That's another sort of special group that you need to know a lot about things that other legislators who are inlanders don't know. And she worked very hard for the shoreline in particular.
And her son, who also eulogized her, you know, spoke of her love for the shoreline and spoke of her love for the state parks. And he made the point of saying that she fought for the state parks. She fought to keep the taxes low. She fought to keep the admission rates low because she understood that there were people who that was their vacation. There were middle class people who live in Connecticut whose idea of a good time was a week at Hammonasset. And sadly, of course, there's no tax upon a tax. But he finished the story by saying she probably has never stepped foot in a state park. But she understood the importance of what she did, and that was kind of the legislator she was.
All right. I'm assuming Alison and I, as we're reporters, we have less to say about Eileen Daly, although I did cover her over time. All right. So we've got a little bit of time here, but before we go to break here, we're going to reserve the final segment for a look at the national scene and let each one of our panelists talk about the thing that interests them most going into Thursday night's debates, or perhaps they're more interested in the possible rise of Joe Biden. Anyway, before we do that, just a quick conversation, and Tom, I'll let you kick it off, and then I'm going to go to Allison on this, but you've got a lot of stuff up on your site right now about this MGM lawsuit. This is essentially saying to Connecticut, well, it's one thing for you to have arrived at this accommodation for tribal casinos through the Supreme Court decision that kind of made that possible. But now you're making this law that says that these so-called slot barns, a term I really love. I love the term slot barns.
Slot boxes.
Yeah. These slots that the tribes could also create these so-called slot barns close to the border as a way of kind of intercepting Connecticut gamblers who, like Shad, are heading up the Connecticut River to gamble in the new Springfield casinos. Wait a minute. You can't do that. You can't carve out this kind of non-tribal exception for tribal casinos. Do you think this thing has any legs, any traction?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think rather than dwell in the minutiae of the legalities of it, I think it points out that these people from MGM, they're in the game and they're here to play. And they have a lot of money and they're just not going to sit back and let the tribes in Connecticut do what they want, or let the legislature or the governor or whoever. And Jepson did warn them at least once and twice. And Office of Legislative Research and Fiscal Analysis also warned that there's going to be problems with the way this bill was written. So this is not going away.
And Allison, I feel as though we're watching an industry managing failure right now. You know, in other words, the handle is down at the Connecticut tribal casinos. It's not going to go back up again ever. Now we're so worried about the threat from Massachusetts that we want to authorize somebody, anybody, to build slot barns. I'm going to say slot barns a lot for the next couple of years. Slot barns just kind of intercept. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's a winning strategy or a strategy that can ultimately redound to anybody's credit.
It kind of illustrates desperation is the mother of invention. You know, the slot revenues are down from what Connecticut was enjoying, so we have to scramble. And a little bit like when the gas tax that was imposed was supposed to make people, conserve fuel, and then everybody started getting hybrids and more fuel-efficient cars, and then they start complaining that they're not collecting as much on the gas tax. So now what can we do to replace the gas tax?
Mileage tax, right. GPS.
By the way, we know where you're driving.
The tribes were perfectly happy to try to get a piece of the Massachusetts action when the bidding was open, and now suddenly they're offended by what Massachusetts is doing.
Hypocrisy. I'm shocked. All right. We have to take a break so we'll have time to talk about the national scene. We'll do that. We'll come back after this. All right. Do not adjust your radio. This is Colin McEnroe. I'm guest hosting The Wheelhouse because, and it's sort of fitting given the fact that we're heading into our conversation about the national political scene. The rumor is that because Rand Paul needs somebody to impersonate Donald Trump as he prepares for this debate, that John Dankosky is now in a Kentucky bunker with Rand Paul doing his best Donald Trump impersonation. We don't really know where John Dankosky is, but he's somewhere. Meanwhile, I've got three of my favorite journalists here in studio with me, Allison Lee Cowan, Kevin Rennie, and Tom Dudchick. We're talking about the national political scene. Before we do that, let me just say the producer of Where We Live for The Wheelhouse is, in fact, Tucker Ives. Katie Tularsky, I think the big kid, is on the board for us today. Alex Dubin, I think, might be on phones. I can't really see in there. But and, of course, Betsy Kaplan is running around being magical. Betsy Kaplan is magic. All right. So thanks to all of you. Thanks to everybody else who helped out here today. We've got various interns that I should probably thank as well, because our interns are great. They are. Well, I just mentioned Alex Dubin. Also, Robert Dozier and Charles Smart are with us today. You can continue the conversation, by the way, after this on our website, Where We Live. It's WNPR/Where We Live.
And was Kyone sleeping late today? Where's my picture?
She's in Hawaii. She's been in Hawaii for 2 months. At WNPR.org, by the way, /Where We Live. And you can see I don't do this very often. And yes, Kyone Wolf's been in Hawaii for more than a week now, and we miss her terribly.
And you can tweet us at WNPR and Where We Live.
And Where We Live.
WNPR Colin.
You can call us at 860-275-7266. So, you know, I mean, we usually do around this time start taking a little bit more of a snapshot at the national scene. The wheelhouse is usually more about Connecticut and local politics, but how can we not talk about this? So, in the last couple of weeks, I mean, it's like every week, Kevin, I think, well, so Trump's at 18%. That's as far as he can go. And and then, no, Trump's at 20. Trump's at 23. Trump's, you know, just where does this stop?
Oh, soon. I hope it stops soon. I'm not a Donald – I don't like Donald Trump. I think he has an unspeakable presence in the presidential campaign. And on tomorrow night, my advice to the other nine candidates is death by a thousand cuts. Just keep mentioning his rather quixotic political past, which involves supporting a lot of Democrats and his close relationship, it appears, with Hillary Clinton. And I think that – he can be undermined in that way. He's not going to be knocked out by a frontal assault. It's just – it's not going to happen. He knows what to do with those. It's the smaller mentions of what his record has been.
What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I have a number of observations. I'm saddened by the turn that presidential politics has kind of taken into a – reality-based television drama. And, you know, a lot of people are looking at this race through Theodore White's eyes. And, you know, a little memo here, it's not 1960. And campaigns have intrinsically changed. And we may have just hit that change in our presidential campaigns that maybe it is now more like a reality show. And we have to be on message and to do funny things and be unscripted and be out there and be real and fly on corporate jets and land choppers. And so I think there's a fundamental change going on in American politics at the presidential level based on the length we cover these candidates, how long we cover them, the intrusiveness of them always on, all the time. And I think there's a change.
I don't know. In some ways, it's always been a reality show, just sort of with different media. I mean, you think back to the Nixon-Kennedy debates where everybody who heard Nixon on the radio thought he'd won. You know, there's always a superficial element. I don't know. Allison, where are your thoughts going here?
I think it's only good for Hillary to have Donald be at the front of the pack and everybody else sort of the Greek chorus behind. I think it's just that there's 17 candidates even is good for Hillary as the front runner on the Democratic side. I can't really begin to fathom why voters do what they do. I kind of thought Mr. Trump would be doing less well after his comment about John McCain, frankly. I thought that was the end. And I'm flabbergasted to wake up and see this, and I can't explain it.
But I think it makes a good contrast to Hillary. So you have Hillary in the envelope, in the box, kind of shading her questions, not taking full assaults from the reporters. And then you got Trump out there who's just like dialing into TV shows and talk shows and being the unscripted and giving those quick answers. And you want to ask me about anything? Sure, I'll tell you whatever I want. As contrasted with Hillary being in a very protective envelope and being very guarded, which I think the American public sees that.
Yeah, you know, to me also, Kevin, when there's a race like this, there's a number that I want to know, and it often doesn't show up in the polls, or you have to sort of play with the crosstabs of the polls to see if you can kind of get it. And it's the number that I call the I can't imagine it number. And although you and I saw some of Linda McMahon's races differently, I always thought that whatever her I can't imagine it number was, it was a problem for her. In other words, there were undecided voters who were not persuadable.
I think she knew also it was going to be very hard to get to that 50%.
Right. Because yes. there's an I can't imagine. No matter and, what you do, no matter you know, what the, you say, there's an I can't
and,
imagine it
and
number.
And Donald Trump's advantage at the moment is that there are 16 other candidates. As candidates start dropping out, I'm going to guess, but my feeling is that they're going to go to their supporters are going to go to candidates other than Donald Trump. And so as the race narrows, his ceiling is a lot lower than the alternatives.
You know, let me just grab a quick call here from Peter in Stanford because we haven't taken a call all day. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Let me give you my take on the Donald Trump and also Bernie Sanders in some degree, is that these two people are not party picked, and they tell it like it is. They're unscripted, and they're getting to a chord of the populace that they're not part of any machinery, and Donald Trump is going to just say it as it is, and I think it's refreshing. You know, people want to buck the system, and I support both Trump and Sanders for different reasons. I know they're on opposite ends of the spectrum, but they're refreshing. They tell it like it is. They don't care what people think. They know this country's in trouble. We are in trouble. We are in trouble that the right knows. We are in trouble that the extreme left knows. That the center is a blind spot. And we're in trouble in the manufacturing front, in the global front, in many fronts. I don't think the mainstream politicians get it. I don't think the mainstream parties get it. But the people get it. And, that's why his numbers are up. Because, something has to change. It has to change radically.
But also that first thing that you said, Peter, which is a great point, Allison, is that the thirst for authenticity. So Mark Leibovich, is that his name, the This Town guy? He did a big piece on Hillary for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, a couple of issues ago. And a lot of it was about her quest to present a version of herself that seems natural and authentic. Although that's a little bit like thinking about your signature. The more you think about it, the less it becomes like your signature, right? That you, the more handled your authenticity becomes, the less authentic it is.
I think this actually helps her, all of this. There clearly are people out there who want authenticity and want an unscripted candidate and find that refreshing. And every election you have a group of those folks who are very very insistent about it. They might have backed Ralph Nader at one point, or Ross Perot, all these outsiders, but they never get to anything close to the critical mass you need. And there are quite a lot of people who actually want to be led. And that's the sort of the sad truth of American politics, is even in our democracy, people want to be led. They want a grown-up. And grown-ups are scripted and controlled, and everything's in place, there are no variables that haven't been anticipated. And Hillary is the consummate. I'm in control, and I haven't even allowed too many other people to be on the dais with me. I'm the front runner and the only runner, practically.
Kevin, I wonder if you see it that way, though. I mean, first of all, her unfavorables keep going up. The poll numbers suggest that this is a problem.
Are becoming shocking, and I think that the Donald Trump story is overshadowing this in what's getting attention. But there is a poll out, I think, last night from New Hampshire, I think the WMUR, which is a serious poll. That shows her 5 points ahead of Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire. That is a huge change. And it's only August. She may have to recalibrate again her strategy. But there is something going on with Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party. There's no doubt about that. He's going to be – first of all, the idea that Bernie Sanders doesn't care what people think, as the caller suggested, is preposterous. He absolutely – you don't stay in politics at that level for that long without caring what people think. He's got an act right now that's becoming popular. But it's not because it's spontaneous.
And I think he's gaining traction here in Connecticut too. If you look at all the liberal Democrats who are following him at all his little TV viewing parties, especially up there in Litchfield Hills, I think traction.
I think also if her numbers continue to track the way they are, it does become more and more of an invitation for somebody like Joe Biden to get in. I don't think Biden can get in even, with the kind of narrative that he's built up over the weekend, unless he's rescuing the party. But if it does seem as though Hillary Clinton is losing the party and losing the election and losing the electorate, then you have to think of a guy like Biden getting in. Or, like, the Democrats never have that sort of business person, the Carly Fiorina, the Herman Cain, but Howard Schwartz, Maureen Dowd said Howard Schwartz, the CEO of Starbucks, could conceivably get in. And there's a guy, like, you know, we all have some reason either to love him or hate him. Well, listen, we have to sort of wrap things up here. I want to thank everybody who helped out here today, but also especially our wonderful guest, Kevin Rennie, lawyer, Hartford Current columnist. He and I are in the insight section because we have so many insights at the Hartford Current. Tom Dutchick, well, you got to go to that site, ctcapitalreport.com. You'll realize that we're all just basically regurgitating stuff that Dutchick collects for us. Allison Lee Cowan, freelance reporter, former editor and reporter for the New York Times. She has looked into the dark heart of Connecticut corruption and politics for perhaps too long for anybody's soul. All right, so, and we'll be, I don't know what's happening tomorrow. I'll be on later today with a show about puppets, which I suppose is kind of a nice follow-up to this.